Thanks, Greg. So what I'm going to try doing today is the work that I'm going to present is being conducted by three master's students and two PhD students and one postdoc. I'm just here representing everyone. So this is an outline of my presentation. I'm going to walk through a few population growth impacts and some of the controversial issues that we have going on in Florida with restrictions on fertilizer use. And some of the research that we have been conducting looking at nitrogen transport in urban watersheds. So I think it's a good idea to look at where we are now, where we were a couple of years ago. So if we look back about 160 years ago, we had 2% people living in cities, and within a short span of 60 years, we had about 30% of people living in urban areas, cities and suburbs. And fast forward to another 60 years, now we have 70% or 50% of the people, they're living in urban areas, and it's estimated that in the next 30 years or so, there will be 70% of those people living in urban areas. Now, closer to home, we see that we have a large population which is living in urban areas or close proximity to urban areas, about 80%. So when we have increase in population, we need to build homes and other infrastructure. And this is a cartoon that shows that about 70, 80 years ago, this is how Florida landscape looked, primarily green, which is a forest area. Within 70 years, we converted a large part of this forest and agriculture to urban areas as population increased from 0.5 million to 20 million. Looking into the future, this is the I-4 corridor that you see on the picture. On the left, I'm trying to find my cursor here. Okay, here it is. This is the Tampa Bay area. This is Orlando. So the red is projected to be urban population growth impervious areas. And we have seen this classic cartoon before that as we begin building, we change from natural landscape, forest or agricultural, to urban areas, we increase the impervious areas. And when we do, in the process, we also increase the surface runoff component. And we reduce the groundwater recharge or so on. So in other words, when it rains, a large amount of water will run off impervious areas. This is my extension slide. And it enters into storm drains, then goes back into the streams, rivers, and estuaries. And in the process, it takes away all other things that we have in urban areas, nutrients, pesticides, other contaminants. So if we look at nutrients in U.S. water bodies, they are still our primary pollutants. And about 14,000 water bodies are impaired because of nutrients and bacteria and so on. What you see in the image is a stormwater retention pond, which is a typical feature in Florida landscape that has high concentration of nitrogen and phosphorus. If we look across the country, more than half of the rivers and streams and lake acres and estuarine are impaired with nutrients and other components. Generally, we can generally group the nutrient problems. When we look into inland waters, what's typically fresh water, we see phosphorus limitation. What that means is phosphorus is a limiting nutrient. And in Florida, we have Everglades where we have phosphorus limitation. As we go into coastal areas, Tampa Bay, Miami, Orlando, for example, we typically see nitrogen limitation, and I will come back to that in a minute. So what I'm going to show you is this is a Tampa Bay area. There are four counties, about 3.5 million people live in this watershed. There are four rivers that drain into Tampa Bay estuary. So the first thing I'm going to show you is a long-term data of 20-plus years collected by one of our state agency. In this case, you're looking at number one, which is one of the monitoring points in the Tampa Bay estuary, where the total nitrogen is close to 1 mg/L. And if you look at what is the composition of that total nitrogen, 85% of that is organic nitrogen, and we have some nitrate and some ammonia. Now, when we go a little bit inland, this is one of the rivers where we have been working for the last few years. We look at our total nitrogen concentration is about 2 mg/L, and we have about two-thirds of that, or we have 75% of that nitrogen is organic nitrogen. And a third example that I'm going to show you is one of the lakes. It's Lake Manatee. there's also, we only have one dam in Florida, this is on Lake Manatee. And this supplies drinking water for about 300,000 people in Sarasota and Manatee counties. So let's look at nitrogen in this lake. Beginning from 1983 to 2008, this was a data that was collected by one of the utilities. So what you see on the graph is there was an increase from 1983 to about 94. This is largely because the large area in this watershed was agriculture, mostly tomatoes and strawberries, that's what we grow. And the seepage irrigation, if you have heard about it, you will think, what were they doing in Florida? But it's Florida. So this is a part of the seepage type of irrigation. Large quantities of nutrients were applied. And then we had a couple of new rules and regulations that restricted how to grow. And we also had water shortages. We switched from seepage irrigation to drip or sprinkler irrigation. And over a longer period of time, they saw that the nitrogen concentrations in the lake have been kind of stabilized. If you see the dotted line, this is the EPA's numeric nutrient criteria value for Florida colored lakes, about 1.7. So in some years, the value is probably bounced back around this line. When we look at nature of nitrogen in this lake, we see that it's primarily organic nitrogen, again, what we have been seeing in streams and other places. Now let's look at phosphorus, because we need to consider both of those nutrients when we are looking into water quality problems. So the plot here is same. We're first going to look into Tampa Bay estuary, and I know some of you are going to think my units are wrong, but this is actually total phosphorus again in the Tampa Bay estuary, about 1 ppm, and part of the reason is this is Central Florida, where we mine phosphate rock fertilizers. So we have natural rich phosphorus geology, and we see high concentrations of total phosphorus. This graph probably is different than what you see in other parts of the country, where a large proportion of your total phosphorus is particulate or other phosphorus. In this case, we see it's all orthophosphate, soluble phosphorus. And we have very little another phosphorus. Now let's go back into the river, and the units again are correct. This is milligrams per liter. We have 1.7 milligrams of phosphorus in the river. Again, largely soluble phosphorus or orthophosphate. Now let's go back a little bit more inland and look into the lakes. This is the same graph. If you noticed in the total nitrogen graph, we saw that the nitrogen was kind of tailing off. With phosphorus, it's different. We saw there's a continuous increase over the period of time. And if you look at the numeric nutrient criteria value, is somewhere here. So as a result of, if we look at nature of organic phosphorus, this is again orthophosphate. Because we have large, high concentration of phosphorus, and many of you might know Redfield ratio concept, that if you have 16 parts nitrogen, 1 part of phosphorus, that's a perfect recipe for algal blooms. So if the ratio is less than 16:1, we say this is nitrogen limiting nutrient. Now if you look at what's going on in Tampa Bay, we have almost 1:1 ratio. And as a result, no one talks about phosphorus in Tampa Bay. It's all nitrogen. So it's too much, we can't do much. So all our efforts are how can we reduce nitrogen in our water body so we can minimize some of the algal blooms and other problems. So switching over to impacts and nutrients, we know these are essentially plant nutrients, and we need these nutrients, but we need them in the right places, not in the water bodies. And this is what generally gets most people's attention when they see algal bloom. This is a picture from St. John's River. And then they start complaining, and then you get, as an extension specialist, you get a call, I have green stuff, what's that? And otherwise they're fine, they don't care. And some of the algal bloom problems that we see in the state of Florida, they're not typically to our state, and we see these problems wherever there are nutrients. There are nutrients, plant food. So closer to home, this is one of the paper that came out a couple of years ago that looked at concentrations of one of the organisms, Crenia brevis, which causes red tide blooms. And what you see is the darker the color, which is red, that means the higher concentration of this organism. And as you go back into the Gulf, the concentrations are about 1,000 cells. Closer, you have much higher concentrations. So one of the theory that got some policymakers' attention was that maybe it's the nutrients that are coming from land, and that's making these blooms last longer and more severe, which is a good guess. But again, after these events, we had a series of algal bloom events in 2004, 2005, and that really sparked an interest on looking at what other sources of nutrients are. And believe it or not, when you tell some of the elected officials that it's organic nitrogen, so some of the questions I got, so it's good? So that tells you that how knowledgeable they are about some of these issues. And this is a typical Florida landscape. I want to do two things here, show you a picture, and you see all the homes, and there's a retention pond. So the idea is we are a coastal state, so we need to drain those high-intensity storm events. When it rains, all the water goes into a stormwater pond, which is connected through hydrological network through a stream, river, and it goes back into Tampa Bay estuary. So a previous speaker showed a slide on some other state laws to restrict the use of land fertilizers, which include both nitrogen and phosphorus as well. And in Florida, we have a couple of those things going on as in other parts of the country too. So because of the large blooms, and we also have a lot of water in Florida, there were some efforts to look at nutrient pollution or control nutrient pollution. And I'm going to just begin with the 2007 is what they were calling fertilizer ordinances that restricts the use of nitrogen fertilizer. We also had an urban turf rule that was passed that limited how much phosphorus could be in a fertilizer. And then in the beginning 2009, some of these ordinances, they were mandated in some areas. So fast forward within 7-year time period, right now there are 64 Florida counties or municipalities that have some kind of fertilizer ordinance. And this might range from recommendations on fertilizer timing and sometimes to complete rainy season blackout time period. So just a little premise here. We in Florida, we get about 137 centimeters of rainfall, and about 50 to 70% occurs during our hurricane season, June, July, August, September. Typically, our storms are short duration, high intensity, lasting anywhere from 10 minutes to 40 minutes. So the premise here is that when you have high rainfall and you have fertilizer material that's sitting outside, there's a potential for loss of this fertilizer material to get into water bodies. So this blackout period has been most controversial. If you ever Google, you will find several articles back and forth between people who want to apply nutrients, which is largely fertilizer industry and other people, and we have NGOs which says no, you don't need to. One of the another issue with blackout period was they suggested that the fertilizer should be banned. Because how would you enforce the fertilizer use in blackout period? So currently in Pinellas County, that's where St. Petersburg is, you can't buy fertilizers during June to September time period. And in other areas where you still have a ban, but you can still get fertilizer if you need to apply. So the issue here is with enforcement. How would you enforce it? So I'm going to switch to some of the nitrogen work that we have been doing to better understand the nitrogen biogeochemistry. This is one of the Alafaya River watersheds where we've been doing quite a bit of work. About 1.6 million people live in this area. The drainage area is close to 1,100 kilometers square. Again, nitrogen is our main problem, and we don't worry about phosphorus. So what we did, and the first step was we looked into the long-term data that has been collected by several agencies. This is one of the watersheds. And as you will notice that the black sites are the main stem of the river where they had monitoring sites. So we pulled data from existing agencies. So to give you a bigger picture, this watershed is about 20% urban, residential, and buildup. And you see these yellow areas in the map are the urban areas. We also have some agriculture, tomatoes, and some strawberries. That's red. And if you look on the east side or the right side of the graph, which is that's where all the purple is, where there was active phosphorus mining, and we still have some areas are reclaimed partly in the South Prong sub-watershed, but in North Prong we still have some active mining. So then there were other sites where we thought that, okay, these are more urban sites, more than 18% urban area, and then we had two sites which were less urban in this case. So we thought, let's look at the data. So the first thing we did was, okay, let's look into this 19-year data to see if the nitrogen concentration has been increasing or decreasing. And we saw that nitrogen concentration, in fact, has been increased in this watershed. And this is not surprising, because during this time period we had the changed land use was changed in the watershed, about 8% increase in urban areas and about 7% decrease in pasture and forest land area. The other thing we did was let's look into the different sub-basins, what concentrations are there. So this graph shows you the total nitrogen concentrations in different sub-basins. The main stem is on the left and the developed are in the middle. So we do see that in more urban sub-basins we have higher nitrogen concentration, which is should be expected. And we also have a numeric nutrient criteria value for Central Florida, and this river is 1.65, so we just kind of bounce back right there. Another thing we did was we were able to find some data looking at nitrate and organic nitrogen. So we saw that nitrogen is in fact higher in developed sub-basins. What was more interesting was organic nitrogen. So Peter, you might be interested in this slide. When you look into urban and more forest-dominated areas, you will think you will have more organic nitrogen in undeveloped or relatively less urban areas, but we see quite a bit of organic nitrogen signature. Part of the reason is it's Florida, it's hot and humid, everything grows fast, we have lawns. So maybe some of those material, organic material, we might actually have more input in some of the urban areas than we see in forest areas. Another thing we did was, this was a monthly data, so when do we sample? When it's nice and sunny. Does that represent actual sampling conditions? Probably not. So we thought, okay, let's go. We had a grad student who was willing to drive to 10 sites in the watershed every Friday before he go home and drink beer. So then he collected this sample over a two-year time period. I'm just showing the data from 2013. Then we separated nitrogen in the stream water into the nitrate, ammonia, organic fractions, which is dissolved and particulate. The first thing we noticed was the total nitrogen now is very similar, either in developed and undeveloped. And part of the reason is I think we were with weekly sampling, we were capturing more realistic conditions than what they have been doing with the monthly data. Another thing that got our attention was that in this stream water, we have a large proportion of dissolved organic nitrogen and particulate organic nitrogen. So then we began wondering, where is that coming from and how does it ties up with our fertilizer ban story and so on. So the third thing I'm going to show you is this is some of the grab sample data we collected 2 years ago. So we went into four neighborhoods, and if you look, this is our stormwater drain. This is just an example. Let's see if I can move the cursor. So we had people standing in the vehicle when it's raining, so grab the first sample. And then we looked at concentration. We were trying to identify some sites for more work that I'm going to show in the next slide, that which sites might be good for this type of work. And again, we see that there's a large organic nitrogen signature in most of these neighborhoods, whether we are looking into apartments, townhomes, or some low-impact development, which in fact actually had more organic nitrogen, more plant material. So I'm going to talk about another research based on some of the work we did. We identified a few sites. What you see is the GIS mapping of one of the urban neighborhood. In this neighborhood, we have about 30% area is impervious homes, lanized roads, sidewalks, and so on. We have about 66% canopy and grass, and we are trying to map this. This is kind of a preliminary slide. What you see on the left side is a stormwater retention pond. And I'm going to show you a picture of the storm drain network. This is the same residential neighborhoods. This is the storm drain network. So all the runoff enters into the storm water, and then it goes right into the storm water pond. So the area of this neighborhood is about 13 hectares. So what we did at the outlet was we put autosampler, we put rain gauze, we also put all the instrumentation that we could afford to put, also a pH meter, so we can look at what's happening with the, what's in the runoff as it's getting into the outlet. And the data I'm going to show is only for nitrogen, but we also looked at phosphorus and some of the other contaminants. So this data was collected at 15-minute intervals last year from June to September. So when we look at total nitrogen, this data is separated into months, not really the best way to present this data, but there's too much data here. So when we look into nitrate and ammonia, we see that our nitrate gradually increases a little bit after June event. when we look into the organic nitrogen, we see biggest organic, which is our particulate organic nitrogen in the beginning month. And we have a theory because during the dry month preceding the wet season, all those organic material builds up in the watershed. And as it starts raining, it pretty much cleans up. And you have a large amount of organic material that's in fact getting into the pond outlet. When we look into the distribution of these different fractions, this is the data on percent of total nitrogen, we see that there is a high organic nitrogen again in the runoff, but we also see quite a bit nitrate, and we are continuing to do this work in this neighborhood and also instrumenting 2-3 other neighborhoods that have a different plant material. So one of the questions that we've been asking was that if you have largely organic nitrogen, what does that mean? How much of that organic nitrogen is bioavailable? This is a data from one of the paper where we looked, we saw that in urban stormwater runoff, 60% of the DON could be bioavailable. So one of the questions my grad student Mary has been looking at, the nature of organic nitrogen in stormwater. What you see is the Van Kremlin diagram, which pretty much looks into all the carbon compounds in a water sample, and then it spits out the oxygen-carbon and hydrogen-carbon ratio, and on that basis, you can look what's actually in your sample. And this is her data looking at that. In the stormwater runoff samples and also the pond outflow, we see the signature of lipid, nitrogen, and amino sugar, which are much more bioavailable. She has also done some bioassays, which shows that some of part of this DON is, in fact, bioavailable. So one of the implications is that if we look in Hillsborough County, we have more than 2,000 stormwater ponds. So we need to acknowledge that they could be potential source of labile DON in this case. So I'm going to conclude. Do I have a minute or two? So I'm going to conclude with the two angles. And when I give this talk, I have done part of this on the research side to policymakers. They're okay because they don't really understand. They think organic nitrogen is good, as I said before. So we see that organic nitrogen is dominant in our stormwater runoff and in stream water data. And we were able to get more realistic data by using intensive sampling program. And by capturing the storm events, we are learning about organic nitrogen. One of the goals is to characterize the nitrogen sources so we can do a better job at controlling their transport to stormwater ponds and so far into streams and water bodies. So for some of the nitrogen management strategies, we need to look at organic nitrogen. And most of our BMPs are based on controlling fertilizers. We rarely look at organic nitrogen inputs. Some of our bioavailability data suggests that organic nitrogen is bioavailable. This is a slide that makes most policy elected officials uncomfortable because they think that fertilizer bans were really good till last year when in Sarasota County they had the biggest algal bloom. So they were like, what happened? We banned fertilizers. What did we miss? So one of the goals that this I gave them, showed them this slide, and they were very uncomfortable, but that's okay. So one of the reasons that we have been telling them that you can ban all these things, but that's not really going to solve the problem. Yes, you're using common sense approach. Don't put fertilizers when it's raining. And that's something we know from years of agricultural research. What's the first thing we do? Don't apply manure when it's going to be raining or frozen soils. But when we look into the nitrogen story, in this case, it's much more complex. And even though you can ban one input, it's a good idea you're reducing the input, but it's not going to solve all your problems. And that also links with we need to look at other alternative sources. And I'm going to conclude with this slide. You probably saw this graph. What you see is this is, again, Tampa Bay watershed. The blue areas are the areas that are served by wastewater treatment plants and all the red areas where we have septic systems. So in Florida, we have 2.5 million systems, many of them in coastal areas. And some of the we also work on septic systems. Some of our data, this is in groundwater monitoring and septic drain fields. We are looking at about 5 ppm organic nitrogen. And we are coastal watersheds, very high connectivity of groundwater and surface water. So we need to be looking at comprehensive sources, and we need to better understand before the policies and other things are formulated. And I think I'm out of time. Thank you.